When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I shouldn't believe in love at first sight, but I think I do because that's what it felt like and I've never felt it before.
Why do you think you shouldn't believe in love at first sight?
Because it doesn't feel like a smart thing to believe in.
Hello and welcome to Love Lives, a podcast from The Independent where I, Olivia Petter, will be talking to different guests each week about the loves of their life. Today, I am delighted to be joined by one of my favourite authors and podcasters, Caroline O'Donoghue. She is the New York Times best-selling author of Promising Young Women, Scenes of a Graphic Nature, and the All Our Hidden Gifts series. She's also the host of the wonderful Sentimental Garbage podcast, and her latest novel for adults, The Rachel Incident, comes out in June. I absolutely adored it, and I can't wait to ask Caroline all about it today, as well as hearing about the loves of her life. So, let's get started. Welcome, Caroline.
Hello, Olivia. It's so nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. So I have been a fan of yours for a while, as I said before. I think I might have messaged you after your first novel came out, Promising Young Women, which I just loved. It came out a few years ago. When did that come out?
I came out in 2018.
I just loved it. And I just loved The Rachel Incident as well. So could you start us off by telling us what The Rachel Incident is about?
Sure. The Rachel Incident is strangely enough, it's a period novel set in 2010, which is weird to think that like now as millennial women, we're kind of old enough to look back on our youth as being of a time period.
Yeah.
And the kind of defining things of this time period is that it's, you know, this character called Rachel, she's 21 years old. She's living in Cork City, which also happens to be where I'm from. And she's working in a bookshop. It's kind of the financial crash of 2008 has really started to trickle down to her and the people she loves. Her parents are going broke. The bookshop that she's worked in all through uni, it's like, you know, the Kindle is coming, book sales are down. It all seems quite bleak. And she's really, you know, for a young person, she's old before her time at the beginning of the novel. And then she meets James, who is a Christmas temp who is made permanent by sheer force of charisma. And he is a closeted guy, originally from the UK, who is now living in Ireland. And these two meet each other and fall deeply in love, a deep platonic love that lasts the rest of their lives. And what happens next really is that this, their first kind of bonding ritual, their kind of their blood pact thing is like every best friendship needs that one big crazy act to solidify its longevity. James realizes that Rachel has a massive crush on her English professor, this man called Dr. Byrne. Dr. Byrne has a very unreadable book coming out that it's like an academic book that's trying to have crossover appeal, which is the worst kind of book. And is trying to be like the Simon Shawarma of Ireland, but is failing. And anyway, they put on a kind of a book launch in the shop, and they think that she's going to like seduce Dr. Byrne at this book launch. And then what ends up happening at this book launch is very different to what they expected, and it ends up sort of propelling the novel in a totally different direction of sort of friends and lovers and betrayal and unpaid internships and everything that we associate with our early 20s, I think.
Yeah, it's great. It really captures that kind of spirit of being in your early 20s, and particularly, like you said, at that time. Like, it's so weird to call it a period piece, but you're so right. It very much is. But I know that, so you originally started writing a different book.
Yeah.
And you were on deadline for that. And that's kind of how this story came to be. So tell us a little bit about what happened there and how you ended up shifting from one book to another.
Yeah. So it's this thing where, so I wrote two novels for adults with my publisher, Virago, and I was contracted to write a third one. And in the meantime, I got swept up in doing a trilogy for young adults. It's kind of my other career. And I love it, but it's so rewarding, but it's also so demanding, because when you're writing a trilogy, What people don't know is that you have to get all those books on the shelves within that first generation of the first set of young people who are reading it, you know? So something that you're interested in at 13, you may not be interested again at 16 or 17, you know? So you have to really grab that first generation. And so my adult publishers were very understanding about the fact that, you know, okay, you just need these sort of 3 or 4 years to work on that. We won't be too pushy, but you do always a novel. And so the novel I had outlined to them was very much a kind of a Black Mirror-y type thing, focusing very much on sort of commercial capital feminism, you know?
Wow, yeah.
Something I think you and I are probably very familiar with and had bumped off the edges of, and I felt was a real defining thing of the sort of, you know, the late sort of Me Too and the post-Me Too era up until now. And I worked in an office that was like a, you know, built itself around that ideology that something can be feminist and commercial at the same time. And I wanted to really explore that using a kind of a Black Mirror type of framework. Mm-hmm. And I worked on this for years, and I was 75,000 words into this novel. And I cared very much about the characters, and I really had it all plotted out and everything. And then a bunch of things happened. One of which was, I think, you know, if you've probably had this experience where a piece of work that you keep picking up and putting down loses momentum really easily. And that's just, you know, often you can get that momentum back by just going on holidays with the book kind of thing, you know, going to a writer's cabin and really focusing on it. And what was happening with me was like the momentum was not coming back, because I realized that there is a type of book that I really enjoy that is not my destiny to write.
That's so interesting. I've been speaking to a lot of writers about that as well, about how, you know, not, it's weird because I think you're often told to write the thing you want to read, but actually it's sometimes it's like, I want to read books that I could never possibly write. And that's part of the appeal.
That's
sometimes
part of it, right? Like, so I think what I wanted to write was the kind of millennial mean girl sort of thing of like mean girl having mean thoughts and fuck society and like that kind of thing. That I love it when like an Atessa Moshfegh does it, but it's just not my destiny. And like I'm quite like a buoyant person, and writing that sort of prose was really depressing me. Like, was really like, on top of it being a depressing landscape anyway, like this was February 21, so it was like that second year of the pandemic where Christmas had just been cancelled and like the weather was awful and it was so cold and everyone was so just depressed. And you're writing this quite depressing book, not depressing in itself, but like depressing characters, I guess, was just bombing me out. And then the third thing on top of that was I realized that like a novel, what that central message was essentially, oh no, the phones. was so like not the vibe. It was like literally technology was the only thing holding our entire society together for that 2 year space. Like we had just had this like global mass vaccination that was largely organized by like, you know, alerts on your phone and like that kind of, and like that was kind of amazing. And like you, people were staying in contact with their families through Zoom and doing the Zoom quizzes. And it was the sort of the society was being held together by technology. And it just felt really inelegant and the wrong time to write a novel that's like, oh no, the phones. Oh no, the technology.
I love that cell. Oh no, the phones. But it does really capture, I know what you mean.
Yeah. And so I sort of like, it was like, okay, my publisher was, it was February. My publisher was like, we really do need this by May, you know? So I was like, fuck. So I sort of set myself the task. I was like, I have to write a novel that A of all makes me really happy, and B of all, I have literally no excuse to open a single Google Chrome tab to sort of research, because that was another thing that went wrong with Oh No, the Phones. Was I was constantly going on these research rabbit holes, because with stuff like tech, there's always more to research and you can get lost if you want to. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to set it during a time and a place that I know inside and out. And that for me was 2010 in Cork, which was the year before I emigrated. And I wanted to get back to a really happy, hopeful time, which was when I was living with my best mate, Ryan, in a crappy little house. And we were working in retail, you know, and that just became the basis of what was a real savior for me. Like, it was such, it was so much fun to write. There's a lot of dramatic, upsetting things that happen in the book, yeah. but ultimately, it's I hope it's a joyful read.
Yeah,
you know?
It is. I think reading it, you can really tell that this is something you had a lot of fun writing.
Yeah.
And you can imagine that it came quite easily to you because it does all just, it's very, very snappy and sharp and very like a lot of social commentary, but it does feel very natural. Mm. And it feels very much like, having listened to your podcast and, you know, read your work before, it feels very much like it is your natural kind of voice and yeah. your kind of like quippy tones and stuff. It's great. And I think everyone who's a fan of your work will love it. I want to ask you about one of the themes in the book without giving too much away, but because for anyone who's read Promising Young Women and, you know, this book as well, there is a kind of a parallel in terms of like age gap relationships that yeah. you write about and power dynamics, and not necessarily even between men and women, but just that whole difference of, you know, when you are someone younger who is going out with someone much older than you, or even if you just have a crush on someone much older than you, like Rachel does on her professor. And I think that's such an interesting area to explore. So I was intrigued to see you returning to it in this kind of different way in this
yeah.
book. What is it about that that you find fascinating and ripe for fictionalizing, do you think?
It's so interesting because when I wrote Promising Young Women, I was 26 and I was full of like rage, like, and also I wanted, you know, many feelings, but rage was a huge part of it. And it was like everything that I had sort of seen in sort of corporate creative London sort of things, and like the kind of sexual dynamics that I saw at play in all these offices I had worked in. And I was quite rageful about that. And the sort of romantic interest / antagonist of Promising Young Women is like, he's quite literally monstrous. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's borrowing from like horror literature in a very like deliberate way. And I really had fun with that. And like, it was a great thing of kind of picking apart those sort of gothic vampire type tropes and working with that. But then by the time I got to Rachel, I'd lived a lot more life. Not a lot more, I mean like 6 years more life, but in this time going like 26 and 33 felt like a very different age. You know, you'd grow a lot during that time. And I kind of realized that, like, even though Fred Byrne from the Rachel Incident and Clem from Promising Young Women, they're both men in positions of power who are kind of abusing their positions of power in order to get sort of drink from the fountain of youth. But Fred, I feel like my attitude toward the character had changed. Like, I have quite, he's not the same as Clem, but it's like, he's just a guy. You know what I mean? He's just like, it's just like, what it is. He's just a human man who like is sort of crumbled under the weight of just A, of all being closeted, and, you know, being a man of a certain generation who's closeted, who feels like he's missed the boat on sort of being able to be a queer man, because he just, I feel like a lot of people who were out, certainly in Ireland when I was growing up, the only people I knew of who were out, and maybe you were the same, were people who didn't have any choice but to be out because they couldn't pass.
Yeah.
And Fred is somebody who can pass, so therefore has never been forced to come out, and so has in a sense been living a lie for a long time. And the delicacy of that, and the sadness of that, and the kind of, you know, I felt a lot of empathy for him, even though he does horrible things. Mm. And so I think the main differences between those two relationships is my sort of maturity, I think. You know?
Can really tell, though, from reading it. And it's interesting what you said about writing the first book from a place of rage, because I'm also now wondering because I'm writing my first novel now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there's a lot of rage motivating this story.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, like, as a female novelist, your first piece of work, maybe rage, because I mean, you know, we as women have so much rage in us anyway that we're never allowed to express and constantly told to kind of keep quiet and keep to ourselves. I wonder if when you are writing a novel as a woman, that's like your first outlet to be like, this is all my anger, and this is what I have to say that I feel like I can't express in my real life because no one will let me, and I can't express in nonfiction because, you know, I'll get criticized for it.
It's so interesting. I'm thinking about this a lot because, like, it's like everyone in the world has had an idea for a novel or a movie, right? Everyone's capable of coming up with like a pretty good plot kind of thing. But it's like, what are the things in your subconscious or in your emotional life that nudges you toward needing to write this story? And like, I think the propeller has to be a very strong emotion. And I think if you've never written a novel before, maybe rage is the one that will do it, you know? Yeah. And as you get further along in your career, it can simply be like extreme curiosity or affection or whatever. But maybe to get that first one over the line, because it's such a weird thing to do, to write a novel, like to like just come out with like, I think I'm capable of inventing a whole landscape and many people in it, and it will be important.
Yeah. And people will care.
Yeah, people will care and pay $16.99 in hardback for it. It's a nuts thing to think about yourself. It's so grandiose and self-important. So maybe rage has to be the propelling emotion.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And the central relationship in the Rachel incident, as you kind of mentioned, is this platonic friendship between a straight woman and a gay man. And I know you kind of drew on some of your own experiences. You mentioned that you lived in a kind of flat in Cork with your friend Ryan, who you thank in the back of the book and the acknowledgements. I always read the acknowledgements.
I read too. I feel very strongly about acknowledgements that they're a short story at the back of the book.
They often are.
And when they're not treated like that, I get very annoyed. Yeah. When it's like a list of names. Yeah. I'm just like, that's not a story.
No, there's always so much going on there. So I wanted to ask you about how you go about drawing from real life stories in your fiction, because, you know, it is something that is constantly weaponized against female writers and constantly told, you know, oh, so this is basically a biography or this is basically about you. So how do you go about navigating that while also still pulling from real things that have happened?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot because I don't think the Rachel incident is any more or less autobiographical than any of the five novels I wrote previously. Yeah. And three of those novels were supernatural fantasy for teenagers. But I've drawn so much from my own teenage life in those books that they function as memoir just as much as the Rachel incident does, just as much as Prom. You know what I mean? Like you're always drawing from somewhere kind of thing. And I think that like, truth in novels is a bit like alcohol and wine, where it's like 13% is probably too little.
Yeah.
15% is about right. 16% of people go nuts, where it's like 16% of people are like, what's true? What's real? We're drunk on this amount of
like
truth you've given us. And you're like, it's really not that much more than normal.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
I think about this a lot as well. And I think the thing that is true mainly would be the emotional truths.
And that's not
necessarily saying this factually happened. But of course, if you're writing a story and you're coming at it from a place of drawing from things that have happened to you, it doesn't necessarily mean you're writing exactly what happened to you, but it's about the feeling that you had and the reaction that you had and the kind of sensory experience. And, you know, obviously that's a really, really good place to draw from for a story.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And like the plot of The Rachel incident is totally invented. Yeah. And I think that the character of Rachel, she's a lot of like biographical things in common with me in terms of like when and where we were born and when we moved to London. But I think of us as being very different people. But the emotional stuff of like, that's how we lived. Like we went out that much. We went to those bars. We did this kind of thing. This is sort of how I acted with men at that time kind of thing. Yeah. That sort of like soupy of like experience and ambience, I think, is probably quite true to life.
Before we move on to talking about the loves of your life, which I'm really excited to ask you about, I have to talk to you about Sentimental Garbage.
Okay.
The podcast I mentioned at the top. I just love it so much.
I do too.
It's so great. And I know that obviously during the pandemic, you did these episodes with Dolly Alderton about Sex and the City.
And they all sat there and they were like, can you remember how we resolved
the
Miranda thing? Oh, I think that she went out to Charlotte and said, oh, I'm moving to LA, I'm in love. And they all just went, yeah, I think that, probably that, but I think we can just do that.
Yeah, but it needs to be done by Thursday, so let's just get it over the wire.
The podcast was already pretty popular, but when you did those Sex and City episodes, it kind of took it to another level, I think, because it was A, something that people so desperately wanted to kind of absolve themselves into at that time, like that really fun criticism of like this cult show that no one's ever really done before. I don't think there'd ever been anything like, I mean, I know people have done podcasts about Sex and the City before, but I think the way that you guys did it was quite unique. And it came at a really, really good time when people, like I said, really wanted that. But I wanted to ask you about how it felt to have that level of attention and that level of listenership and engagement, and then, you know, make like the demands that they were then making of you afterwards to be like, can you please do it for this show and do it for this show, and kind of how that kind of felt and how you navigated that.
It's so fascinating because I'm not a dummy in that, like, I knew that, you know, when me and Dolly had this plan to do kind of a mini series, and we had it in the, we've been talking about it for such a long time. Like, we were on holidays at some point and we came up with a phrase, like, talking about Sex and City for the great American novel, it truly is. And that just made us laugh as a sentence so much. but it obviously was the pandemic that took it, you know, we literally had the time to spend like 3 or 4 hours a week on the headphones. But I knew that, like, obviously, you know that when your friend Dolly Alderton is going to sign on to do a little miniseries with you, that way more people are going to listen to it because she's like a phenomenon, you know. And also the High-Low had just finished, and so people were like desperate. they had this sort of like weekly fix of Dolly for years, and then it was gone, and then suddenly she was back talking so much. That really played into it as well. And so, and even though I was like, it's like I was like, I don't really care about that stuff because, you know, she's one of my best mates and she's like one of the most fun people to talk to in the world. And there was still always a part of me that was like a little bit nervous because I'd never gotten that much attention before. There was a kind of a slight nerviness that like she would be Barbie and I would be Skipper kind of, which is kind of true, but also it's fine. And so there was a lot of tension, but it was like really nice because like I feel like I have something, I think like it's so nice because there was all this content that got absorbed and during the pandemic that changed a lot of artists' lives. Like, I remember, this is like a horrible comparison to make, and I'm not saying I'm this person, but I remember seeing an interview with Anya Taylor-Joy, and she was like, yeah, no one knew who I was. And then The Queen's Gambit came out during the pandemic, and then suddenly, like a year later, I'm out, and like people are out again, and then people are running up to me in the street. And she was like, so the fame happened in like a capsule where it didn't bump off of me, and now suddenly it is bumping off of her, and it's such... there was no trickle down of like slow flat fans.
It's like going into Love Island and coming out and having it's like that. It's just like that.
And it is a bit like that. In that, that like I went into the pandemic as like somebody who was like, you know, pretty like well reviewed, has somewhat of a following, but like not, you know, not a character in people's lives, to then coming out of the pandemic being a character in people's lives and having people coming up to you and you're not on a night out. And
do people come up to you on a
night out? Yeah.
And they want to talk about Sex and the City?
Yes.
That's quite sweet.
It's really sweet. Yeah. And then I remember when it was over, when we finished the miniseries, I remember thinking like, oh, now I'm going to carry on and do other things and talk to other people, but I'm just going to get all these one-star reviews saying, bring back Dolly, you know? But that never actually happened, you know? They stuck around for Skipper, so.
I mean, it's great. I love every episode, and I love the breadth of subjects that you talk about. There was one just on the word like.
Yeah,
and then, you know, you've done all sorts of, it's so interesting, the kind of, because the premise is like talking about, I'm now very conscious of using the word like, is talking about things that we're normally made to feel sort of ashamed of for liking and enjoying and the kind of, and so, but it's interesting how far you can take that subject matter, and there's so much that.
Totally. Like after we did Sex and City, I was like, what if everything could be a great American novel?
Yeah, like, but it is. And like the way that you talk about every subject, it's really fun to apply all of that kind of like critical analysis. The one you did recently on Midnight, the Taylor Swift album.
Yeah.
That one. I'm a big Taylor Swift fan. That was great. If anyone watching this has not listened to that, you definitely should.
I was afraid that one was like a bit unhinged. I was like,
maybe that's why I loved it so much.
No, but people really responded really well, because I think people do have very unhinged feelings about Taylor Swift generally.
Yeah, they do.
And me included. But like, I remember thinking that, like, because it was the level of like, when we talked about Second City, we did a lot of like fantasy role play kind of like podcast Jack Berger might have. Mm. But then I was really conscious when me and Jen were talking about Taylor Swift that we were talking about real people. Mm. And like that feels like that hits a bit different. And I don't know. And so I was a bit nervous that we came across like deranged. But actually, it was great. And I think it's a great episode.
No, it was great. And also, like, yes, she is a real person. But what you're talking about, like, Taylor Swift, the phenomenon, the kind of cult figure, you know, you're not talking about Taylor Swift, the girl who went and had a cocktail with
exactly.
last week. Like, it's kind of the culture around her, of which there is a huge one.
And I think also with Taylor, there's this thing as well of, like, because she's our age and she's grown up alongside us and we've seen her have these relationships, but we've also had relationships like that. Yeah. Alongside her, so we get it. We can project our own experiences of love and romance and disappointment onto her and her, and she provides a really great canvas for that, which is why I think people get more obsessive of her than anybody else.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, I could just, I'm going to stop because I will talk to you about Taylor Swift.
It's a bit at the end of Mastermind, but she says, you know, nobody wanted to play with me as a little kid, so I've been scheming like a criminal ever since. And I just think everybody on earth can relate to that feeling. Do you know what I mean? It's so, the way that she can do extreme specificity while also being so enormously relatable is real skill.
It's crazy.
This Taylor Swift, keep an eye on her.
You heard it here first. Yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right, I'm going to move on to talk about the loves of your life. So I'm obsessed with your first one. I don't think we've had anything quite like this before. So tell us why you have chosen pickles.
Pickles! Pickles, things that are pickled, vinegars, vinegary things, just like anything that sort of hurts your mouth. I remember being actually one of the first things I bonded with Dolly about.
What, pickles?
Pickles, yeah, totally. And yeah, I remember for the first, like, some birthday, she just got me a big jar of them. And I just find that I've been a writer, a full-time novelist for a while now, and you really need a few, as anyone will tell you, you do, like, I think writers love to hide behind this veneer of like, oh, I'm just a mess and somehow things get done kind of thing. It's either one or the other. They either hide behind the veneer of like, here's my bullet journaling, here's my post-it wall, use of a clean office, how I get things done. Or they're like, I'm a mess, I don't even know how. But we really know that the truth is somewhere in the middle, that like most people have a kind of a pretty structured day and a good internal sense of like what can pick them up or lift them out of a slump. And for me, the thing that always lifts me out of a slump is just nailing an entire jar of cornichons.
You wrote, I'm going to have to quote what you wrote in the email when we asked about your loves. You said that pickles really help your writing process and that they are for you what cocaine was for Bret Easton Ellis. So yeah. tell me in your writing process, in your typical writing day, how does that look and where exactly do the pickles fit in? Do you find yourself reaching for them?
Question. When I'm actively writing a novel or a script, the days are quite structured. So I try and get up, I try to like hit my desk at around the same time where my partner is hitting his, so we're not like crazy out of sync. You know, you want to live, you want to run a house, you know. And so tends to be coffee from around the corner in the morning. We go together, you know.
It
is nice. It's nice. You know, me and him and the dog go for a coffee in the morning, take a walk around the block, and then we're both at our desks by just after nine. And then, you know, work till sort of one-ish, go for a proper walk with the dog, come back, and maybe get an hour of work done. And then that kind of thing, like, okay, now I just have nothing to live for, nothing to think about, and my brain doesn't work. Yeah. And so I think I might be like allergic to the pickles is what's happening. Is that... So that's when they can't. It's either, right. It's either a jar of cornichons, yeah, or a family bag of Space Raiders, whichever is more to, yeah, hand. And I just like, just really like standing up in the kitchen, just really trying to feel something. But it's like my brain gets hot, my face gets warm, I can like feel things like really picking,
yeah,
up.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I've never been a cocaine person, but like...
It's the same
vibe. Yeah, it all gets jittery, and then I can get about 90 minutes of like creative work done,
wow,
off a bag of Space Raiders.
Maybe you are a bit allergic.
Maybe, maybe. So when it comes to like a deadline time where like I really just have to get something over the line, and particularly those 3 years when I was writing, 4 years when I was writing the YA stuff, which, yeah, is so deadline heavy. Yeah, pickles were just, they really became a coping mechanism during that time.
So your second love is a type of relationship. So
yes.
I'm really pleased you've chosen this, because we haven't had anyone choose anything like this before. So, yeah, tell us why you've chosen monogamy and what you meant when you described yourself as a boyfriend girl.
So this is something that I've had to genuinely come to terms with about my personality, because I don't like it about myself. I'm getting married in the summer.
Yeah,
it's nice, it's great. And, you know, me and Gav, we've been together almost 10 years, and like that's great. I'm delighted with that. But if I'm delighted with him, and so, and like, the temptation was obviously to talk about him here, but I knew that if I did, he'd be very embarrassed by that, you know, and I'd get it wrong as well. And when I kind of zoomed out, I realized that I do have a bit of sort of shame, because I started dating when I was 13 and I didn't stop. I went out with somebody for 6 months, and then I went out with somebody else for 6 months, and then I just kept leapfrogging. Maybe it's probably why I love Swift so much, because she's the same way. And like, I'd say if I were to really go into the forensics of it, like, since I was 13, I would say I was probably spent about like less than a year of that time single. Oh, yeah. And I find that very unhealthy and weird. Like, and I think when I was younger, a lot of it was to do with that. I've really tried to get to the end of this a lot, like, because I don't think of myself as being this like terribly codependent person. Like, in my relationship, we're very independent from each other, you know, it's not like that. But I think part of it is coming from a big family and feeling like you always want to have somebody who's has to be on your side.
Oh, interesting.
Because my next brother up, my sister, who's 10 years older than me, my next brother down is 8 years older than me, and then next brother down is 2.5 years older than me. So I always wanted to hang out with him, my next brother up, but he always wanted to hang out with the older brother. And so it was always felt like I never had like my special friend, right, kind of thing. Maybe that's, everyone feels that way in the family, I don't know. And so I think I always wanted to have my special friend, like, because even when I was 6, I made my best friend really quickly, kind of thing. And I was obsessed with her, kind of thing. And then when I met Ryan, who inspired the Rachel incident, I was obsessed with him. And like, I just get really obsessed with people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And but I also think that there was something happening. And I think I mentioned this in the Rachel incident as well, of like, one of the reasons it's so attractive to her to have an affair with her English professor is that she's incredibly sexually curious, and she has a huge sexual appetite, but she still is living in the sort of, you know, the leftovers of a very conservative society that is slowly changing into a liberal society. And like, that's a really confusing thing. And as an Irish woman, it's a really confusing thing, because like, you know, a figure that, you know, is often quoted is that the last Magdalen Laundry closed in Ireland in 1996. Mm-hmm. And a Magdalen Laundry was a place where women who were either single mothers or just, you know, deemed promiscuous by their own family or their own community were incarcerated for like the rest of their lives, essentially, and made to sort of work for the state. And it was literally the church and the state conspiring to, you know, I think even Louise O'Neill spoke about this on the podcast. So yeah, it's a huge piece of furniture that lives in Irish women's heads.
1996.
Wow. Yeah. So those women are still alive. They're around, you know, it is crazy. And, you know, the morning after pill was incredibly expensive growing up. I had to use it when I was about 17. And I remember like borrowing a tenner off loads of friends to buy it. And, you know, obviously the abortion thing is a big thing. Always knowing when you're getting ready to have sex in your life that like that could be a possibility. And but that's like all of that stuff that's quite specific to Ireland is also playing against a global cultural context that at that period when we were teenagers was all about, you know, your Paris Hiltons and raunch culture and celebrity sex tapes. So like it was like such a crossroads of female messaging to be an Irish woman during that time, growing up during that time. And I think how it manifested in me, on top of feeling like I was quite lonely in my family, was that I was incredibly sexually curious, but also really frightened of like what would happen if I was promiscuous in any way. And how that manifested was just like, I would have been so much happier, I think, if I just had casual sex. But instead I had to be under the sort of guise of being in a relationship all the time. So, and it would always be like really like, I mean, sometimes some lads were nice. Oh, some lads are always nice. And some of them really weren't. And some of them were just like basically no chemistry unsuitable kind of thing. But to constantly have to be living under this guise of like, but it's okay because she's in a relationship. But like then almost becoming like famous among your group of friends being like, yeah, but you're going out with someone for 8 months really intensely, telling everyone they're the love of your life, and then just moving on immediately. Like it's a bit laughable. Like it's mad. To go back to our friend Taylor.
Let's just keep referencing her every few minutes because I'm so down with that.
And what's interesting is that she's like, she's moved straight on. Like she's moved straight on to, and I think that, I mean, for her, it's probably a lot to do with feeling protected, I think.
Yeah.
Because I think, I don't know why. You know, a lot of the feedback she's getting from her fans is that, like, not necessarily even she's moved on too quickly. I think people got over that pretty quickly, but it's like the kind of man that he is.
Yeah.
I don't really know much about that guy, Matty Healy.
Yeah, no, neither do I. But I know that people don't like that he's going out with Taylor and he's said various offensive things.
Said a bunch of offensive things, but it's like she's responsible for the things that he said more than he's responsible for the things that he said.
Which is always the way, is that it somehow becomes her responsibility just because she's dating him, that suddenly she's going to come under fire because
I think you see that happening a lot. Yeah. It's women being like the guardians of like some kind of moral state.
Yeah.
And I just think that hasn't changed and that's weird to me.
I know you've never been on online dating or dating apps or anything like that. So I want to ask how, because I've written a book about, you know, the perils of online dating.
Yeah.
I want to ask how you met your fiancé.
So I moved here in 2011. Yes, 2011. I remember the feeling, I think I mentioned this on the podcast, but I was like, I remember the feeling of like, because Cork is such a small city and I'd lived there my whole life and gone to university there, that like all these people who I had dated or whatever for a long time were all converging on each other. Like I would see several of them on a night out and finding out that some of them were friends now. And I remember feeling like the claustrophobia of that.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
And there's like in the Rachel incident that she does like a terrible thing. Mm. Well, depending on your sort of point of view, a terrible thing. And then she feels like the shame of that follows her around the place. And I never did something like that, but I definitely mind a sense of like, I feel like I've conducted myself poorly with men and like maybe there's a kind of a narrative out there about me. And so leaving Ireland, I remember being like, oh, they're all dead. Like, they're all dead.
That sounds like a line from the Taylor.
Yeah.
All my exes are dead.
Yeah, totally. Like, of being like, oh, I can just start again in a new country.
Yeah.
And then I actually did date around a little bit here, but it was again pre-internet dating. I mean, there was OkCupid or whatever, but it was still very much the preserve of like people in their 30s.
Yeah.
When you were in your early 20s and 11, 12 here, you still met people at bars and at work, which I think is cute.
Yeah.
I then got a serious boyfriend for about 3 years. He was a lovely man. And then I started working in advertising. And on the first day of the job, Gav took my photograph for my staff ID. And
that's so sweet.
I know. And I remember I was in this like studio or whatever, and just thinking like, oh my God, like this is, it was just a really, I shouldn't believe in love at first sight, but I think I do, because that's what it felt like. And I've never felt it before. And what's sort of depressing was that I think it was quite one-sided. And
why do you think you shouldn't believe in love at first sight?
Because it doesn't feel like a smart thing to believe in. And I'm sort of like,
fair enough. Yeah, true.
And it feels like the kind of thing that legitimizes a lot of poor choices.
Yeah.
Not a great degree of self-knowledge or knowledge about
believing
the world.
In fairy tale narratives. Yeah.
And yet, and so then I went back to my desk feeling quite sort of shaken up or whatever, and then I got a phone call at my desk on the beep. And he was like, hey, sorry to bother you, but I wiped the memory card by mistake, could you come back up? And then we went back up and we had a chat for another hour or so, and then he since admitted he was like, oh, it was bollocks, I just wanted to have a
that's
chat.
So nice. But this is why I always like hearing how people meet, because it's never like, even though like, yes, it's lovely, you're getting married and, you know, it's obviously worked out for the best. Like, it's never a straightforward path to that. It's always like a wiggly road. And you know, I'm single and I, you know, I'm always complaining about how hard it is to date right now. So I'm always interested to hear other people's stories, because it gives me faith, gives me optimism. And it's just like, it's I guess, similar in career journeys in a way. Like, you see someone at the top of their career and you're like, okay, but how did you get to that? And it's always a wiggly route. And I think with relationships, it's, you know, it's not so much wiggly, as it's more like, you know, it's all
right
over the place.
And it's even whatever about suitability, it's also about getting like timelines to match up.
Exactly.
Do you mean?
It's timings. And actually, when you think about the chances of A, falling in love with someone who loves you back, but falling in love with someone at a time when that you're single and when they are single, and you're both in the headspace where you want to date. Like, there are so many things that
and
need
not just
to
date, but really meet someone that you can really do something.
And do you live in the same place? Is it going to be easy? Like, there are so many things that need to match up, and actually, like, the chances when you whistle, like, really, really small.
they're so small. It's a wonder anyone gets born, you know? Like, it's insane.
Okay, finally, we have to talk about your third love, who is a musician who you admit to not really knowing that much about. But I suspect that's not true. But tell us why you've chosen Paul Simon.
Yeah, no, I really don't know very much about him. I know he's had a couple of wives and he was with Carrie Fisher for a bit, which is cool. But I just find that, like, do you ever have this where with musicians where they just keep coming to you and finding you at the right time in your life? And first of all, I think the way he writes is how I would love to be able to write. Like, because I think you can tell from his lyrics that he's like writing to amuse himself almost. Like, You Can Call Me Al is such a bonkers song. But it's always this thing where he is writing in this way that's kind of a bit mad, but when you drill down into it, it actually makes total sense. You know, that thing where he looks around and around and he sees angels and the architecture and spinning in infinity, and like that's what that sort of is, thing of being in a new place and looking up, and that's how it feels. And I remember years ago I went to Graceland, that's in Elvis's house, and that song Graceland meant an enormous amount to me because it was the favorite song of my friend who at the time was dying and is now dead. And it was a song that we always like sang together, and it was really meaningful. But I was in Graceland and I was thinking about that song, and there's a line in that song that says, I'm looking at ghosts and empty sockets. I'm talking about ghosts and empties. And I thought it was so weird because, like, you're walking through Graceland and it's like a historical site, but it's also from the 1970s. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like, it's so weird because in this continent, we're so used to old things and like walking through palaces and castles and old structures. But America's so new and so young, and it also it doesn't have an Arthur's Seat or a Stonehenge. Yeah. Really, because it destroyed all of that, yeah. like with yeah. its genocide against yeah. the Native Americans. They don't know anything yeah. about it. They're yeah. just like, here's the stuff we've made. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it's so weird to walk through a house that's like a spiritual place where people come together and like cry and like feel things. But also you're looking at electrical plugs in the wall. It's so weird. And it was weird to be like, oh, Paul Simon thought it was weird too, you know? Yeah. And I just think that's so incredible. And then when I was writing the Rachel incident, it was such a hard time to just get out of bed, you know, because it was, you could have not put on clothes for that whole period of time and no one would have known. And that lack of accountability was really eating away at the souls of people. Like, it was just a slobby, sad time.
Yeah.
And I remember finding the song Cecilia, which is Cecilia, you're breaking my heart. I love it so much. And it just like, I used to play it every single morning when I sat down to my desk to write Rachel and to get me in the mood and just sort of like a bit like the Pickles, just yeah. like get my sort of blood flowing and my heart pumping and like able to feel joyful about the world. And I feel like I wouldn't be able to, he's like my greatest writing inspiration, even though I don't know anything about him. And he's just like gotten me through a lot of difficult points in my life.
Yeah, I mean, I loved what you said about him when we asked you who your loves are. You said how he's an artist that can both rise to meet me in my sadness, but also cheer me up and force me outside yeah. of the house and outside of myself. And I really love what you wrote because I think it really captures, A, what is so brilliant about your brain and the way that you write. But I also really related to it because, you know, like I said, as someone who writes and spends a lot of time in their own house talking to their cat and in their own head, yeah. writing is quite a maddening thing. It's yeah. It's a very mm-hmm. isolating thing. You spend a lot of time alone in your own thoughts, in your own head, ruminating on things, inventing things, drawing from, you know, emotional truths and things that have happened to you. How do you go about doing that and maintaining a modicum of A, sanity, and B, just like reality and like a sense of what's going on outside of the house and outside yeah. of your head? How else do you kind of navigate that?
It's tough, isn't it? Because I find that like, yeah, when I'm sitting down with the work, like I really enjoy our job, you know. Mm. I'm, you know,
it's amazing. Yeah, yeah, it's yeah. amazing.
Dragging yourself away can be hard, but what is worse when the job does not feel like it's good for you mm-hmm. is when you're out and you're in nature and like you talk to your cat, I want my dog, you know, that's how yeah. I to decompress or whatever, and I can't think of anything but myself, you know.
Yeah.
It's not even that I'm thinking intensely about the characters or like what's gonna happen next or mm-hmm. setting. I'm just like, you know, answering fake interview questions in my head. I'm like imagining like controversies that may arise after my dealing with an issue in a book. It's just this fucking endless self-involved yeah. boring self-chatter that is like it's like Hannah Horvath to the power yeah. of like your worst self, you yeah. know, it's like that's when I don't like it, when you can feel yourself stepping outside the imaginative creative process and instead you're in this weird ego spiral of like, well, I see so and so on Instagram has gotten some kind of list that I haven't yeah, got, yeah, like yeah, that yeah. is gross and yeah. not good.
Yeah, it's awful. I think it's so, but it's so easy to get seduced into that kind of world and then it yeah. becomes like a downward spiral and it's not just being stuck in your head. It's also, like you said, being on Instagram and looking at what other writers yeah. are doing and comparing it to yourself. And it's like, I think you really need very kind of sturdy tools to get you out of your own head.
Totally.
And like, for me, the only thing that really does that is exercise, I think. Exercise is a really good
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, it's great.
Because it just
yeah.
forces you to think of something else and you're thinking about your body. I try to meditate. I've never really been able to.
No,
I
nor
wish I was like, oh, I just meditate on Disney. yeah. I just can't do that.
But even like, it's really hard when you're exercising to not go yeah. back to that space in your head. Like, I find that I've sort of gone on a kind of a intermittent fasting with social media where I'm allowed to have Instagram on Thursdays and part of Sunday.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You know, sometimes I break it, but I try and like yeah. limit it basically. And then I just delete Instagram for the yeah. rest of the week and re-download it when I need to post about the podcast, right. for example. I get there's times when I'm good at it and times when I'm bad at it, and also it's like I need to be dieted with podcasts as well, because there is definitely, I am really waiting for the study to come out that really says that like podcasts are making people depressed.
Interesting. What do you think? It's because we're constantly listening to something and not.
Yeah, I think music is better for you than podcasts.
Yeah.
If we're going to rank distraction techniques or whatever, I think bouncing around listening to Paul Simon or whatever and like thinking about angels and the architecture is probably a more mentally healthy process than like, I'm going to listen to two women in America review Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. Like, and just like, why? Because, and I realize that I'm creating this content as well, but I also think that I get into, when I'm not in great mental spaces, I just chain these things and I'm not really listening
that's
what it to
is.
It. I'm just like, I just like the chatter in my ear.
I'm not
really committing to listening to it. I'm not really thinking my own thoughts either. I'm just in this nether space of floating around my neighborhood, not feeling great about my life or the world.
Yeah, well, that's what I think the problem is if you're constantly outsourcing things and you're constantly looking for distractions, you're not sitting with, you know, just...
You're not really achieving deep thought on anything.
And you're not really present in any moment. Yeah. You're constantly elsewhere, whether it's like in another person's conversation or you know, whatever. And it I don't think that is good for your brain.
No. I'm trying to more and more now when I go on like walk the dog, like ringing someone.
Yeah.
I think that is probably a big help, even though it feels like we're getting further and further away from chatting on the phone.
It's weird. It shouldn't seem like, I know whenever I go for a walk, if I don't listen to music and I don't listen to a podcast and I don't call my mum, I'm like, wow, I'm quite proud of myself. I just walked.
I know.
Total silence.
It's pathetic,
isn't it? So pathetic. It's wild. It's a strange world we live in.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is all we've got time for. Thank you so
much,
Caroline.
Oh, this has been so good. I've loved it.
It's been so nice to talk to you. That's it for today. Thank you so much for joining us. You can listen to Love Lives on all major podcast platforms. You can also watch us on independent TV and all social media platforms and on all major connected devices. I will see you soon. Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.